Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of Conspiracy You Can Believe In, the show about conspiracies and plots that actually happen. Now, this is a bonus episode, which means we're not talking about a conspiracy. We're just talking about some extra information related to the previous episode, which was about the 1996 election in the Russian Federation, which Boris Yeltsin basically stole with the help from the IMF and the United States. Today, I wanted to give a little more information about mostly the stuff that happened after and up to the present day. Basically, what Russia's deal is politically after the fall of the Soviet Union. Another thing you may notice with this bonus episode, I'm just talking here. I've got kind of an outline that I'm reading off of, but it's not scripted. So just bear with me for that. My sources for this episode are mostly the sources that I used for the previous one, The Tragedy of Russia's Reforms by Peter Redaway and Dmitry Glinsky, and a book called Russia Without Putin by Tony Wood. That book is pretty short, and I recommend it if you just want a basic overview of why modern Russia is the way that it is today. Before we dig in, I want to get one thing out of the way and say what this episode is not about. This episode is not about Russiagate. If you want to learn about Russiagate, the Russian interference in the 2016 election, there are dozens of other podcasts and news reports that you can read or listen to. This is not about that. Not saying that it isn't important, but when we're talking about domestic Russian politics, it wasn't really a scandal that has much impact. Honestly, I don't think it had much impact on the actual outcome of the 2016 election. I think it's more of like a domestic corruption scandal that a presidential campaign did seek out help from some foreign entity. That's more of like a Watergate thing. Honestly, I think some of the reporting around Russiagate, when they actually started talking about Russian politics, it became a little unhinged. I feel like in America, we have a tendency to put the United States or the experiences of Americans at the center of absolutely everything. And like I said, Russiagate, not really that important when you're talking about the domestic policies of Russia itself. I don't think Putin expected Trump to actually win the 2016 election. And when you start talking about things as like, oh, Trump is controlled by Putin or that this was an act of war, I think that's when we start to say things that are pretty irresponsible. So that's about it. Not saying it's not important, but it's not really related to much of what we're talking about today, which is what happened in Russia from the fall of the Soviet Union to the present day. Now first, I want to get back to the fall of the Soviet Union, because that resulted in Boris Yeltsin becoming president of the Russian Federation, and my main argument here is that Putin is largely a continuation and a maturation of the policies of Boris Yeltsin. It is not a break with the 1990s. As a lot of people think. So again, how did they get to Yeltsin? Well, you know, we discussed in the previous episode, there was a lot of discontent in the USSR by the 80s. There were people that were dissenting with the system or halfway dissenting, you know, just general malaise. And a lot of that, you can't really boil it down to anti-communism. Many, many people, probably most people in the USSR, liked the welfare state. They were not expecting to completely break everything all down. And when they got a reformer in the Politburo, Mikhail Gorbachev, you know, his plan by the 90s, when it was clear the Soviet Union was not going to continue the way that people had known it, he kind of wanted to make like this social democratic federation of countries, not really the shock therapy and immediate reversion to capitalism that they got under Yeltsin. The shock therapy was not popular. That is not really what people expected, and it was implemented from the top down, from Yeltsin's inner circle, onto the Russian populace, and that's how you got, you know, immediate privatization, the removal of price controls on basic goods, the destruction of what existed at the public health system, the increase in crime that happened because of the sudden social collapse, and all of that caused just almost unmeasurable suffering on the average Russian people. And Putin was part of Yeltsin's inner circle by the end of it. And Putin, I would argue, is part of Boris Yeltsin's legacy. So how is it that a guy who was in the administration of a president that left office with single-digit approval rating, how was he in power for the past 20 years? Well, it's pretty complicated, and that's what I'm going to talk about. One thing to remember is that Russia is not run by Putin as some kind of king. There is, of course, much power centralized under the presidency, and he is very powerful, but there's a lot of interest groups that he has to manage. There are a lot of other people that he has to please, and he has to also manage the expectations of the general populace of Russia, and we'll get into all that later. So he is not the only important person in Russia, and I feel like a lot of times with the reporting in the United States, it's all centered around him without ever really talking about, well, you know, what are his policies? What is his policy history? How did he get to where he is? So let's start with Putin's career. Now, a lot of hay has been made, especially in the Western press, about Putin came from the KGB. And it's true. He was a KGB operative in East Germany during the Cold War. But I don't think that's really as important as the stuff that he did in the early to mid-90s. He was always a pretty low-level KGB operative, and he went from that to being an aide and kind of like a deputy mayor to this guy, Anatoly Sobchak, who was the mayor of St. Petersburg, which is where Putin is from. It's the second largest city in Russia. It's also a very beautiful city. I recommend going there if you have the means. So after Sobchak loses an election in 96, Putin is brought into Yeltsin's ring in Moscow, and he becomes head of the Office of Property Management, and basically that means he's in charge of officially divvying up state property into private hands. So that's a very important office. It was kind of out of the public eye, but he was the person negotiating the handoffs of state-owned enterprises, formerly state-owned enterprises, to the oligarchs. So by 1998, a lot of those oligarchs and a lot of those operatives in Yeltsin's cabinet are gone. That summer in 1998, Yeltsin just fires everybody, but he starts promoting Vladimir Putin. He becomes the deputy prime minister at one point, but he, most importantly, he becomes the head of the FSB, and this is the successor to the KGB. It's like the Security Bureau of Russia, the Russian Federation. Putin also becomes Yeltsin's heir apparent. So when Yeltsin resigns on New Year's 1999, Putin immediately takes over. And the first thing Putin does is he gives a full pardon and amnesty from any investigation into Boris Yeltsin. Yeltsin was very corrupt. His family was involved in a lot of shady business deals. He was definitely going to prison if he actually got investigated. So Putin put a stop to that literally the first day in office. Later on that year, and keep in mind, Putin hadn't been elected yet, so elections were due by 2000, and this is his first year in office, there are a series of horrific apartment bombings throughout Moscow and southern Russia near the Caucasus. It was never actually clear who did it. Hundreds of people died, and if you think about it, you know, this is psychologically terrifying. These people were attacking huge apartment buildings. This is where a large portion of the Russian population lived, in these huge, you know, apartment blocks that were put up in the 50s after World War II. It was kind of the symbol of the Russian city, and they were being blown up. So, you know, if you think about it, like, you are an average Russian person living in one of these apartments, you would see on the news a place that looked like just where you lived blown up with all of the occupants killed. There are horrific terror attacks. Officially, the government did an investigation and found Chechen rebels to be responsible, Islamist rebels in Chechnya. Now, I say that's the official explanation because there's a lot of conspiracy theories around this, that the apartment bombings were somehow orchestrated by the government. I don't really buy a lot of those. I don't think there's a ton of evidence, even though there's some bizarre things that happened, like at one point in the city of Ryazan, people were evacuated out of an apartment building because they were told it was going to be blown up, that they found a bomb in the basement, and they found FSB operatives with what they claimed was a bag of sugar and that it was all a drill. And it has been a long argument over if this actually was an explosive or not. I don't know about all that. Without getting into it, I think that the investigation was rushed to blame it on Chechnya because the Russian Federation, Putin's administration, really wanted another war. But there was also a group in Dagestan at the time, which is another Russian republic in the Caucasus, that claimed responsibility for the attacks and had the motive to do it because the Russian Air Force had just bombed some villages in Dagestan, and I think that might be the culprit. But we don't know for sure. So anyway, these apartment buildings are blown up, and Putin immediately goes to war in Chechnya again. This is the second Chechen war. You'll remember before Yeltsin's second term, he had the first Chechen war where he was pushed by his advisors to invade Chechnya, which had declared independence. This was the second time, and after the apartment bombings and after that got pinned on Chechen Islamic militants, the Russian population was clamoring for war in Chechnya and to finally bring this conflict to some kind of resolution. And they did. And they did that by bombing the hell out of Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, by mass displacement. It was a pretty brutal conflict. A lot of civilians died, but Russia decisively won. And Putin eventually placed this local leader, Akhmat Kadyrov, whose son Ramzan Kadyrov currently controls Chechnya, and it's like their own little fiefdom, but it's still within the Russian Federation. That's basically how they solved the Chechnya issue long-term, was just kind of have like a local strongman run it for them, but as long as he's loyal to the Kremlin, then everything's okay. So, yeah, they decisively won the Second Chechen War with a lot of bloodshed, but this raised President Putin's approval rating significantly, and he sailed into his first election in 2000, defeating Zyuganov again. Gennady Zyuganov was the opponent of Boris Yeltsin in 1996. He ran against Putin in 2000, and Putin decisively defeated him with a lot of help from that Second Chechen War. Now, in Putin's first term, in these early days, and especially after like September 11th, people forget this, but he was viewed by a lot of the American political establishment, you know, kind of what they call the Washington Consensus, the people that are for a hawkish foreign policy and, you know, protecting America's interests overseas. They had kind of a cautious embrace of Vladimir Putin because he spoke out a lot about fighting terrorism. He really wanted to be part of this war on terror because that coincided with the Second Chechen War, which he was fighting against many Islamic militants in the south of his country. So he wanted to reach out to kind of be part of this war on terror. And a lot of his rhetoric in that early first term of his was about being like this macho fighter of terrorism, but also like this centrist problem solver who was going to get things done and continue the reforms of Russia, and that they weren't going to go back to communism. So very openly like a center-right sort of civic nationalist. And this got a lot of people in Washington to like him. Thomas Friedman, who is a well-known centrist columnist for the New York Times, wrote op-eds praising Putin during Putin's first term and said that people should, quote, keep rooting for Putin, in that beautiful prose that Thomas Friedman gets paid millions of dollars to fart out in the pages of the New York Times. But it's difficult to think of today, knowing what the relationship is with Putin, but it was a lot warmer than you would think during his first term. And Putin wanted to extend that to the West. One of the things that he really wanted to do was to join NATO. And this is where we start to see the first friction with the West. Now, if you think about it, NATO was intended as an anti-communist, Cold War-era alliance against the Soviet Union. Well, by the time Putin was in office, the Soviet Union no longer existed, and Russia wasn't communist anymore. And what he kept seeing was this expansion of NATO eastward into former Warsaw Pact countries. So he was saying, well, why can't we join NATO? And it sounds weird to Americans, probably, to think of Russia joining NATO, but again, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, so why not? And if not, then what is the point of NATO? Now, it was basically an open secret at this time that NATO expansion, the main purpose was to sort of extend American influence and hegemony eastward. These countries that had been part of the Warsaw Pact, well, we're just going to nab up as many of them as we possibly can at the expense of Russia. Russia was never intended to be part of this. So understandably, a lot of officials in Russia, especially the more nationalist-minded ones, saw this as, you know, something of a threat. Now, there was one point in 1999, just as Clinton was about to leave office, Putin actually approached both him and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright at this function and asked them point blank, can I join NATO? And Madeleine Albright pretended not to hear and actually like looked away. And Bill Clinton just kind of stammered and could only assure him that personally he would agree with that, but politically he couldn't. But personally, he was okay with it, but obviously it was never going to happen. And so as NATO membership would continue to expand eastward or threaten to expand eastward, this continues to be a major sore point with U.S.-Russia relations. And that's about when it started, in Putin's first term. So while Putin is positioning himself as this macho, tough-on-terror, centrist problem solver, let's compare Russia in the 2000s to Russia in the 90s. Now, I said earlier that my argument is that Putin is in a lot of ways a continuation of Yeltsin's policies in the 90s. But one way that he's different is that he always has been more willing to use state intervention in the economy in certain ways, specifically in the oil and gas sector. Now, this does not make him left-wing. I think that this is a mistake that people left, right, and center in the United States make all the time. But get this out of the way. Vladimir Putin is not a communist in any way. I remember going to protests and stuff and, you know, and seeing people with like the posters about Putin and or Russia, and it still uses hammer and sickle stuff, and it just makes me cringe. And there's some people, you know, on the far left in the United States that think that Putin is some kind of left-wing ally or something. That's not the case at all. Putin is a capitalist and on the right wing of the political spectrum. One of the things that makes people think that he's way different from Boris Yeltsin is that he nationalized the oil sector and the gas sector in Russia. But, of course, that's pretty much the norm for most countries that have large reserves of fossil fuels. Saudi Arabia has a state-owned oil company, Aramco. They're not communist. No one mistakes them for being left-wing. But this is one way that Putin differentiated himself from Yeltsin, is starting around 2003, 2004, he maneuvered against a lot of the oligarchs that had bought up either shares or created large oil companies. The biggest one was Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who owned Yukos. He was an ally of Yeltsin, and he started positioning himself as an opponent of Putin. He was an oligarch. He did not come by his money through honest means. He was one of those people in the nomenklatura who, you know, used their connections in the state to buy up a bunch of export businesses, and then he kind of used that to buy up an oil company in the 90s. Putin muscled him out of it and bought up his company, basically, and then, you know, had some probably bogus fraud charges that were politically motivated and ended up getting him in prison. I remember being in St. Petersburg in 2005, just after Khodorkovsky was sentenced and sent to prison, and I remember seeing a protest from a very small liberal party called Yabloko that was pro-Khodorkovsky, and they were giving out like pamphlets about Khodorkovsky, and nobody cared because this guy was an oligarch. And yeah, his sentencing was politically motivated. It was unfair, and he was targeted because he was a powerful, rich opponent of Putin, but he was a crook. And by that point, people didn't like crooks, and they liked that Putin was going after these guys. So he was able to build popular support as an enemy of the oligarchs. But he actually wasn't an enemy of the oligarchs. Remember, Putin worked in Yeltsin's administration. He was the guy in charge of putting money in these people's hands. What he did was he turned Yukos into a state-owned or state-majority-owned enterprise. But these are companies that are run just like any private company. They have a corporate board. They are run not for the public good, but just to generate a profit. And he put the people on that board. These were oligarchs that were friendly to him. And he made sure to get the support of oligarchs by punishing the ones that stood out as enemies to Putin's administration. But if you were willing to play ball with the government, then you could continue being an oligarch. Another reason I want to stress here that nationalizing the oil industry and gas industry in Russia is not really as left-wing as it seems is because the reason he did that is because the oil and gas sector is the main source of revenue for the Russian Federation, along with their value-added tax. They don't get the bulk of their money from their income tax. They have a flat tax structure at 13%. That's basically all you pay. So the economic health of the country and the coffers of the country, basically, are entirely dependent on oil and gas prices. This causes a lot of inequality further on down the line, and as I said earlier, Putin is a right-wing capitalist, so he has yet to respond to that inequality with some kind of robust welfare state, and I'm not holding out hope. But this also means that just the general economic health and public opinion in the country is entirely dependent on those oil and gas prices. And during the 2000s, that like 2000, 2008, they're pretty good. So there's this stabilization that happens, and this builds Putin a lot of goodwill for a long time. Because remember, people had just come out of the 90s where there was this political instability, the average life expectancy dropped, people were dying of violent crime, drug abuse, alcoholism, infectious diseases, preventable diseases, all sorts of terrible things. And then, we have all this oil wealth, and it is building revenue for the country, and it feels like they actually have, you know, a real country now. This is all fleeting because they don't have any kind of sustainable tax structure. It's all based on oil revenue, and there's a ton of corruption. But this is, you know, how the general populace that would be supportive of Putin is thinking. So what are some other ways that he was a lot like Yeltsin? Well, one of the main ones is he has a huge media apparatus to support him. Pretty much, there's no major channel that you're going to see, no major news channel that you're going to see that's really critical of the president. And this was true of Yeltsin during the, especially mid to late 90s. He has consolidated support among all the state media and major networks, and that's something that was true for Yeltsin as well. So that's not something Putin invented. It's just been perfected over the past 20 years. And another thing that was kind of a holdover from especially the second term, Yeltsin's second term, is that Putin is what I would say is like a civic nationalist, not like an ethnic nationalist for Russian ethnicity. There's a term in Russia called Rossiyskiy, and that means a citizen of Russia, as opposed to Ruski, which means like ethnic Russian. I would say there, his party, United Russia, which is kind of like a catch-all party of power, it's the party that represents most groups in power, is a conservative civic nationalist party. And a lot of ways that that's been expressed, for example, is like Yeltsin, Putin has a strong relationship or alliance with the Russian Orthodox Church, which especially after the fall of communism kind of surged back into existence. And a lot of Russians have a relationship with the Russian Orthodox Church, and they're closely allied with Putin. Kind of nationalistic conservatism, I think, is also expressed through the anti-gay laws. In 2013, they passed laws that forbid so-called gay propaganda to youth. This basically outlawed gay pride parades or exhibits of sexuality or any kind of public freedom of LGBT people. This is something that had broad popular support in the Duma, the Russian parliament, and I think among a lot of voters in Russia, too. But Putin wholeheartedly embraced it. He's a huge homophobe. So there is a strain of social conservatism that I think is characteristic of his time in government. Speaking of his time in government, it is important to point out that to avoid going against the Constitution, in 2008, he stepped back from running for president again because he couldn't. And he had this guy, Dmitry Medvedev, run for president under the United Russia banner. Medvedev was kind of like a puppet, not entirely. He had his own slightly more liberal administration, but Putin became prime minister. And I said in the last episode that the Russian parliament, the Duma, is basically a rubber stamp. That changed when Putin was prime minister, so he was kind of the power behind the throne. After 2012, Putin became president again because he could run for president again. But by this time, he was in an entirely different situation. Oil prices in 2008 had collapsed, and in 2011, there were legislative elections that probably had a lot of fraud, and people noticed. So there were massive protests, probably the largest protests since the 1990s, since like 1993 in Russia when Yeltsin had to open fire in his own parliament. It didn't result in getting Putin out of power. I don't think it ever came close to that. But what it did do is very briefly create this broad coalition of opposition and very open opposition to Putin and United Russia, the United Russia Party. So let's talk about who the opposition is. Now, like Yeltsin, this is another way he's a lot like him, Putin employed this use of controlled opposition. And what that is it's a group or a person that on paper is an opposition party or candidate to the party or person in power, but really they're just there to pretend to be an opposition party or candidate to the person in power. Now, Yeltsin did this to an extent during the 1996 election, where I didn't really talk about this during the last episode, but there were these kind of third-party candidates that were running that Yeltsin immediately scooped up after the first round of voting, and he would do things like getting opposition leaders to sign a pledge that, you know, they wouldn't oppose the president during this important period of reforms or whatever. And he would do that periodically throughout his administration. So it's kind of like this, a fake opposition. But this was really perfected under the past 20 years in modern Russia. Let me just give you a couple examples. The first guy, and I regret I didn't have enough time to talk about him during the last episode, but this guy, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, he is the head of a party in Russia, it's still around today, called the Liberal Democratic Party. Don't put too much stock in that name, Liberal Democratic Party, because it's actually the furthest right major party in the Russian Federation. Vladimir Zhirinovsky is kind of known for just saying really outlandish things of, you know, far-right statements that he threatens to go to war with all these different countries all the time, real saber-rattling nationalistic stuff, racist stuff, misogynistic, anti-Semitic, like all that kind of nonsense. I mean, the guy is a clown. But the thing is, that's how he got his start, was he was paid to basically be a public clown to represent the democratic movement in the late 80s in the Soviet Union. It's very likely he was paid by the KGB to set up this party called the Liberal Democratic Party and just say all of this crazy far-right stuff. So people would associate that with a group called the Liberal Democratic Party. The thing is, though, he kept it up all throughout the 90s, all up to the present day. Now, there was a period where Zhirinovsky did pretty good in legislative elections in the early 90s in the Russian Federation, and where he was basically the main opposition party to Yeltsin. But he was never really all that serious about ever taking power. So he would agree not to oppose Yeltsin on certain things and not really try too hard to actually become president or anything like that. And this continued to the present day. The LDPR is still active in Russia, but they're not really an opposition party. They largely agree with most of the policies of the Kremlin, most of what Putin's policies are, except in a few cases on the local level where they are an opposition party. They don't put up much of a fight. That's not what they're intended to do. There was another group in the early 2000s called Rodina. I remember seeing a Rodina rally when I went to St. Petersburg in 2005 on a study abroad thing, and I thought I had stumbled across a fascist rally. These people had armbands. I saw a bunch of skinheads hanging out. They had yellow, black, and white monarchist flags, which is normally, you know, a big sign that this is a far-right rally. I mean, it turns out Rodina was nominally a center-left nationalist party, but it was fake. It was pretty much set up to be an opposition party to United Russia. Remember, I talked about in the last episode the so-called Red-Brown Alliance, where they tried to make the political left of the new Russian Federation and the communists look like they are these crazy far-right nationalists. And with Rodina, that was really played up. They put out a lot of anti-immigrant ads, very racist rhetoric about immigrants from the Caucasus, from Central Asia. And all of this was a very good foil to Putin, who was trying to portray himself as this sensible civic nationalist, you know, that would be a president for all Russians, much like Yeltsin did in 1993. And this isn't to say that there aren't ethno-nationalists in Russia. There definitely are. And a lot of them formed an opposition to Putin for a long time because he just wasn't as racist as they wanted him to be. But I would say a lot of them got folded into supporting or voting for him, at least, after the invasion of Crimea, which was another military conflict that Putin used to rocket his approval rating. The nationalists were, of course, very pleased about that, and so this would-be opposition was pacified. There's also the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, which is probably the closest thing to maybe an opposition party. Just I say that because they're the ones that run candidates against Putin for president, but they don't really do much. They're not really that communist. They have this weird mix of just Soviet nostalgia with pretty extreme social conservatism, and I would say that in most other countries in Europe, they'd probably be like a right-wing populist party. They're extremely anti-immigrant. Then there's some smaller liberal parties that have existed over the years throughout Russia. Parnas, Union of Right Forces, Party of Growth, they're not important. You know, these are people that really like privatization and stuff like that, like what happened in the 90s. A lot of these parties are run by various oligarchs who had not been squashed yet by the government or either brought into alliance with the government. And they don't have much of a base of support. Maybe among some more well-to-do liberal professionals in the cities, but Not a lot of people are going for that after what happened in the 90s. So not super important. There is one guy, though, that is important, and that's Alexei Navalny. Now, you've probably heard of him if you watch news about Russia in the United States. But I would argue that a lot of what you've seen is not the whole story. Now, Alexei Navalny calls himself a liberal to Western audiences. And in the U.S., you think that means center-left. He certainly wants you to think that. Alexei Navalny is right-wing. He is a right-wing opponent to Putin. He runs to Putin's right until very recently when he tried to reinvent himself. Navalny was hit with a lot of politically motivated embezzlement and fraud cases and possibly poisoned by the Russian government, and then imprisoned on a parole violation for these obviously politically motivated charges. And that did get a lot of genuine outrage, I think, from especially people in cities all over Russia relatively recently. I'm not saying Navalny isn't a political prisoner. I am saying that his politics are horrible, and it would be a mistake to set this guy up as a martyr or some kind of hope to run against Putin on a national level. First of all, he would lose. And second of all, his politics are just not what he says they are. He used to be a member of the liberal Yabloko party in the early 2000s, but was kicked out because he insisted on taking part in this thing called Ruski Marsh, Russian March, which is an annual gathering of far-right monarchists, fascists, anti-Semites, far-right ethno-nationalists, skinheads, that kind of thing. Yabloko is a center-to-center-left liberal party. They didn't like that, and they kicked him out. You know, they didn't want him fraternizing with these people. Navalny argues that he was trying to preach to these people and turn them away from this ethno-nationalism so that they could become good liberals, but I don't really buy it. Around the same time, he made this TV appearance, like this kind of comedy sketch where he pretended to shoot an image of a Muslim cleric from the Caucasus and said something like, "That's how you deal with cockroaches," and was trying to promote private gun ownership, with the implication here that you can use the guns on people from the Caucasus, who he implied were cockroaches. Then in 2013, he ran for mayor of Moscow, where he ran on an explicitly anti-legal and illegal immigration platform. These riots broke out in southern Moscow because an ethnic Russian youth was believed to have been killed by someone from Central Asia or Chechnya or something like that. It was never really clear who the perpetrator was, but these riots broke out and the police responded by arresting hundreds of migrants from Central Asia, people who were basically the target of a pogrom. Navalny endorsed the riots on his private blog at the time. He referred to the migrant workers from Central Asia and the Caucasus as, quote, hordes of legal and illegal immigrants, and then said that, quote, if there is no fair way to resolve conflicts and problems, then people will create it themselves with primitive and desperate measures. So basically he was saying, you know, it was okay to have this pogrom against Central Asian migrants and people from the Caucasus because, well, there's just too many of them here, and if outbreaks of ethnic mob violence and police violence against these people happen, well, you know, it's kind of their fault in Navalny's mind. Now, he changed course on that over the past year or two. He was also kind of a libertarian, very pro-market kind of guy, and now he starts talking about income inequality, and, you know, he actually isn't the person that believes those things about migrants, even though that's been his stated position for most of his political career, but because he railed against corruption. But anti-corruption politics can only take you so far, because you can have all sorts of other noxious views in addition to people shouldn't steal. But like a lot of other people that got a following by standing up to the Kremlin, he was pretty much neutralized as a threat. And it's a mistake, I think, to look at Putin and his allies dealing with threats with such a heavy hand. Navalny was basically thrown in prison. But I think it's a mistake to interpret these very brash actions from the Kremlin as a mastermind plan. Putin gets talked up a lot, especially I think in liberal outlets in the United States, as, you know, this kind of puppet master. And honestly, I think for the past decade or so, he's really just been kind of white knuckling for the past 10 years. In both foreign policy and domestic policy, I think he's very reactive, making very bold decisions very quickly without much thought for long-term effects. You know, people think of the annexation of Crimea as like, oh, well, you know, he got what he wanted. He was able to consolidate all this domestic support for it, and people in Russia loved it, so it looks like Putin won that one. But it also had the effect of scaring the hell out of otherwise friendly countries that are in Russia's orbit. Belarus was pretty freaked out by Russia just going in and taking a bite out of another country. And there were other countries that were part of the former Soviet Union that had similar reservations about it. That's going to affect Russian foreign policy, I think, for some time. And throwing Navalny in prison, whatever you think about his political views, whatever Russians think about his political views, it did spark a lot of protest because this was an obvious overreach and for political purposes. And remember that Russia gets most of its revenue through those state-owned oil and gas enterprises, not through taxation. They do not have any kind of progressive tax structure. It's all a flat tax. So when those oil and gas prices drop, if there's some kind of economic crash that may affect the fossil fuel markets, then that might affect his popularity at home. Now, United Russia is still the party that's in power and has a lot of support throughout the country, but that's mainly because there's really no other alternative. And there hasn't really been especially any left alternative to United Russia. This is a problem, I think, for the country, largely because the inequality is so bad. You know, they have this flat tax structure. The welfare state got carved out in the 1990s, and people have started to notice. Putin, as I said, is a right-wing capitalist, so his way of dealing with economic problems is austerity. That's the tool that he knows how to use. So, for example, in 2018, he wanted to raise the retirement age, I believe, to 60 for women and 65 for men. He signed that into law, and he got some of the biggest protests against his government across the country that he had ever experienced. Raising the retirement age is not popular, I would say, in any country, but especially not in Russia, where, remember, shock therapy caused the average life expectancy to drop, and many parts of the country had not recovered. This meant that the retirement age that Putin then signed into law in 2018 was now over the average life expectancy for men in many parts of Russia, especially in rural Russia. Now, because I would argue he is the ideological successor to Boris Yeltsin, I don't think Putin is ever really going to come up with a solution to this issue because he's ideologically opposed to it. He's a free market guy. He's not some kind of social democrat for, you know, all the times that he's able to employ some kind of populist rhetoric. He doesn't actually believe in it. So one example is when he was running for president the last time in 2018, he was giving speeches about like, oh, you know, it's so terrible that we have this inequality in this country and, you know, we need to do something about it. And it's like, buddy, you've been in charge of the country for the past 20 years. You know, it's just like we're all trying to find the guy who did this. So I think, you know, the inequality in the country, you know, they're still, I think, reeling a little bit from the collapse of the 1990s, both in terms of inequality of wealth, but also in the corruption that became endemic in Russian government and private business. That's still a huge problem in Russia, and I don't think Putin has really dealt with it, and I don't think he has a plan for it. So that's going to be a problem for him long term. Now let's talk about where Russia's going in the long term. Obviously, it's hard to say, but last year, Vladimir Putin did put up some constitutional reforms that might give us a hint on what his plans are. One of the big things is that it would allow him to run for president again if he wants to, leaving that avenue open. But one of the amendments also gave some more power to the Duma, the Russian parliament, which kind of surprised some people, but I think it means he could be keeping his options open to either be president or prime minister, which, remember, he did that from 2008 to 2012. The new constitutional amendments also put God in the Russian constitution for the first time and had a prohibition on anything except for marriage between one man and one woman. So this is probably a nod to, we can continue to see that cultural conservatism from the government, I think, for the near future. Now, it's important to remember that one of the main reasons Putin and his party, United Russia, were able to get public support in the first place is because they represented that stability, in contrast to the turbulence of the 1990s. Many people in Russia associate Putin with strength, with some kind of national pride. Either they like that he stands up to other people on the world stage, or they like that he was mean to one or two oligarchs at one time. You know, they see him as a break from the 1990s. But like I said earlier, I think that's a mistake. I think he's kind of like a less drunk, a less incompetent Yeltsin. But a lot of his goals are the same: to solidify Russia as a capitalist, market-driven economy that is organized from the top down, from a central bureaucracy. That's what Yeltsin wanted to do, and that's what Putin has put into effect. Well, Putin and many other people around him. But there's a lot of problems on the horizon. There's climate change. There's the COVID outbreak that Russia is still dealing with and initially did not deal with very well at all. This can have all sorts of effects on the health of the population and also in their public perception of what their government should be doing or who their government should be. And younger Russians, I think, might have a different perception. There are people who are voting age now who have never had any memory of the government under anyone else but Vladimir Putin. There is also a declining birth rate of ethnic Russians. And in, you know, countries like the United States that have a long history of immigration and naturalization, you just get more immigrants. And while Russia is a multi-ethnic, multi-racial country, and I do want to stress that, there is a strong opposition to migrant workers, to immigrants from either Central Asian countries or the Caucasus, much like there is an opposition to immigration in this country as well. And I think that's going to be a point of friction in Russia in the near future, just as it has been for the past 10 or 20 years. We also don't know what the economic fallout from COVID is going to be. There could be another outbreak, and who knows how that's going to affect them. And keep in mind, the country's revenues are at the whims of the oil and gas markets. They don't have a progressive taxation. They are mostly dependent on the state-owned fossil fuel companies. So while a lot of people, I think especially in the United States, if they know a little bit about Russia, they see Putin as this all-powerful mastermind who has everything planned out in advance and, you know, he has an iron grip on the country. That's not really how it is. Russia is a complex place dealing with a lot of complex issues. And there's a lot of constituencies outside the government, interest groups within the government that all have an effect on what happens in Russia. It's not just Putin pulling all the levers, although, you know, he obviously is a powerful person. Much of what I think he's going to be doing is reacting to what happens in the near future. And the near future could be pretty turbulent. We'll just have to see. Thanks again for listening. This was a bonus episode of Conspiracy You Can Believe In. I'd like to recommend that book once again, Russia Without Putin by Tony Wood. If you want like a quick read that gives you a nice informed overview about modern Russian politics that I don't think we really see on cable news. It's a great book. I recommend it. Thanks again.